Blog Talk Radio.
Sun's on my back, wind's in my ears. I haven't felt this good in years. See all the people in the field all lined up in a row. We got a couple more long hours of work before it's time to go. We're all...
Hello, and welcome to Those Darn Guys Who Happen to Be Therapists. I'm psychologist and e-therapist Dr. Jim Weaver, along with psychotherapist Hughes Kraft, who's not with us today, but we do have couples therapist Dr. David Sanford from Mexico with us, and we will be boldly going out into the podosphere once again where no therapists have gone before, or failing that, hopefully putting the fun back in dysfunctional and bringing some insights into the issues of life, love, and the search for a decent relationship. And we will be joined once again toward the end of the show by psychologist Dr. Mark Kiefner, clinical director of Bayside Neuro Rehabilitation Services, with some cutting edge brain research called A Minute on the Mind. Hello, David Sanford.
Tim,
you with me, David? Hey, listen.
I am.
Hey, today we... You are with me. Yes, great. Today we have an exciting show. This week's topic is online therapy, and our very special guest is Deanna Merz-Nagel, a licensed professional counselor who is a psychotherapist, consultant, and international expert regarding online counseling and the impact of technology on mental health. Deanna is the co-founder of the Online Therapy Institute and past president of the International Society for Mental Health Online. She has a wide breadth of knowledge about online counseling and supervision, specializing in text-based counseling and supervision via chat and email. Deanna's expertise extends to assisting individuals and families in understanding the impact of technology in their lives, from normalizing the use of technology and social media to overcoming internet and cyber sex addictions, which is a big problem these days, and has written and lectured on many issues with online counseling, including ethical considerations for mental health practitioners with regard to online counseling, social networking, mixed reality, and virtual world environments. Welcome, Deanna Merz-Nagel.
Hi, thank you.
Very nice to have you on the show.
It's good to be here.
Yeah. You're involved in a lot of stuff having to do with online therapy. So wonderful to have you here to discuss all this with us. How did you first get started with online counseling or working through the internet?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Somewhere around 1999.
Yeah.
I had a significant health issue going on with my lungs, and I kept going from doctor to doctor with no definitive diagnosis. So I logged on and joined some support forums, bulletin boards online, and basically diagnosed myself, took my assumptions back to my doctor, to which he replied, "I'm the doctor, not you."
That's their standard response, isn't it?
and then I just kept searching for a physician that would listen to me. And long story short, I was diagnosed with what I thought I had. And I gained so much support and interaction and relationship and knowledge through the internet that it was just a natural progression for me to get into online therapy. And because of my illness, I wasn't able to work outside the house for about a year. So that's about the time all of the dot-com play, and I joined a couple of e-clinics, and I had a fairly significant part-time income just working from home, which was very convenient at the time considering that I couldn't work outside the house. So that's how I discovered online therapy. I was fortunate enough to join ISMO, the International Society for Mental Health Online very early. And so I was mentored by many of my peers who I consider some of the grandfathers and grandmothers of the field. So that's how I got started.
Wonderful. And is your full-time practice now on online?
Well, at some point in about 2001, I had to, quote, get the day job.
So,
so for about 7 or 8 years, I ran a company in the state of Georgia working with families and children, and I always maintained a part-time private practice online. And I was really involved in ISMO and networking and conferences. And so now my practice is, well, I contract with Chappelle FGI, so I
right.
do some email work with them, and I have a small private practice face-to-face. All of my face-to-face clients see me at one time or another online.
Okay.
And I have a few people who see me, who find me on the internet, but a lot of my time is also spent just consulting and training other therapists.
Okay, great, great. What do you see as the advantages and disadvantages of online therapy?
Well, the advantages, over the past 10 years, I think the advantages have been fairly documented. It's convenient. There's no need for travel. It's definitely a plus in rural areas for people with disabilities or who have mobility issues and may not be able to get to an office.
Mm-hmm.
People who live in small towns and they don't want to be the only one sitting in the therapy office with everybody driving by knowing that, oh, Mary must be seeing the therapist now.
Right.
So there's a lot of advantages in that way. And I also think that depending on what sort of online therapy one engages in, it taps different parts of our brain and different styles of learning and processing. And to that end, there are some disadvantages because for instance, for text-based therapy, which is email and chat without any visual cues or paralinguistic cues, there may be some people who do not find that immediately within their comfort zone. But with technology, there is some way, I believe, to fit everybody's need now that we have video conferencing and use of telephone and chat and virtual worlds and being able to meld some of those processes together. I don't see a lot of people being left out at this point.
Yeah, I think that's one of the best things about that is it really can be tailored to people's needs. I've had clients who've had a speech problem and felt so much more comfortable and better able to express themselves and feel more confident being able to do the text-based thing. One of my things that touched me most was working with someone who had CP actually in another country, and you really could not understand her, or you really had to work to understand her. But we had a video conference where she could see me and hear me, and she actually typed her responses to me with her feet, and I think that worked very well. I think that was like a real combination of technologies and regular kind of therapy process that worked so much better. So I thought that was great. The thing about the convenience, I think, is really interesting. I live in Maine, and there are lots of people who live rurally, and it's hard for them to get to a therapist. There's, like you said, at the end of the they know everybody in the community, or there's only one person in the community. There's not much choice, so they have lots of choice. I have people who live on islands that I've had conferences with, video conference or email, and that's worked terrific. So those kinds of people really would have been shut out without that.
Right.
David, I want to bring you in here. You have any questions or comments about what we're talking about so far?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
The first one is this. The two of you have been talking about the very clear practical advantages of online counseling. And the question I've got is a sort of the medium is question. Is there anything, are particular advantages, well, you may have answered this already, but anyway, I'm going to ask it. Are there any particular advantages that come from this particular, from the process of this particular medium that the two of you haven't mentioned yet? I mean the absence of visual cues, the not being physically present with each other, in this case that you don't use video, the particular types of reflection and response that may be that may be a particular advantage in this medium. Could you talk about it a little bit?
I can talk about my perspective and my experience, and then talk a little bit about some of the information that I've gotten from other sources. But for me, I sort of came out of the womb writing, I think. So in some ways, writing is an easier way for me to express myself. So it was a natural fit for me. And I think for many people who love the use of language and text, online counseling via chat and email can be a very powerful tool. I remember somebody told me years ago, oh, you should write a book of letters. And I thought, well, that's kind of odd. I should write a book of letters. you just write such fabulous letters. You should write a book. Well, and in fact, that's what I do every day. I write letters to clients. Mm-hmm. So I do think that there's something beyond what happens in the typical therapy room. And particularly even with chat, when it's a synchronous process and two people are in a chat room, but there's no no real physicality with the two people involved.
Yeah.
There's still an energy that's shared between them. And for me, my other senses kick in, whereas if I'm with them face-to-face, it's just a different experience. And what I was going to share as an anecdote, I wrote an article about the University of Texas in Dallas has a brain center, and they are doing remarkable work with people with Asperger's working in virtual world settings. And people with Asperger's typically do not have a lot of vocational or social skills that they can, they may know it in their head, but they can't necessarily apply it. And what's happening is they're able to go into a virtual world and apply those skills, and it is sticking when they go into the real world. So that tells me that there's some sense of energy that's being transferred that we can't quite put, maybe we can't articulate it yet, but I definitely think that's an advantage. And I think some people who have struggled in face-to-face, actually being online, doing it via technology may open up an avenue that couldn't have been opened up before.
Yeah, my experience is like yours, Deanna, in terms of there's a way that when you write, you can kind of marshal a whole bunch of different things and think through your approach and your way of addressing situations that I find really helpful. I also, like you, have worked with Warren Chappell doing a lot of the e-therapy chat stuff, and e-therapy EAP stuff, and they do a lot they get feedback, a lot of feedback sheets. And you hear a lot of people say how much they got out of this that they had not gotten out of face-to-face therapy. This was a different experience for them, and again, it's different for everybody, but for them, it was an especially good experience, or a better experience than they had face-to-face. So there's some real empirical evidence that people respond differently to different modes, and some people said that they wouldn't even have gone into therapy or gotten some therapy for this particular issue if they hadn't been able to write it, if they'd had to go in face-to-face. So that's another access issue and also another comfort zone issue.
I agree. You know, I also used to manage I oversaw the clinical services for a group home setting for 72 adolescent girls. And they didn't have any problem emailing or texting their therapists about what was going on.
Well,
even in the same room together, typically they had nothing to say, but they were able to use their language differently if they could employ technology. So, and that was a very informal process, but I found that interesting, and it sort of validated my experience.
Yeah,
do you have any hunches as to why that might be? Could it be something to do with distractions that have occurred for these girls when they're physically present in the counseling session that aren't present when they're texting, say?
I just think it's easier to open up with the lack of physical presence. The disinhibition effect takes over, and it's not just with adolescents. I think adolescents are more comfortable in general with technology. But, you know, that happens across the board. And that's why my face-to-face practice, most of my clients are dealing with some sort of internet or cyber sex addiction, because they can go online and be disinhibited and do things that they would never do in their real life or would have never considered doing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Here's a question that's a little bit related to what you just said. To me, counseling or having a session, whether it's in the office or over the phone or the internet, is a great deal about storying. People tell their story in a session, or tell a variety of stories. What do you do if you've encountered this situation? Somebody has either texted you or over the internet told you a story that for whatever reason seems inauthentic to you. I don't mean that they're pretending to be somebody that they aren't, but they are really conveying a narrative which just intuitively you feel is something's wrong with it. I would think that in such a situation, if that person were in the office, you'd be getting physical cues that might indicate that the story that was being told is off in some way.
Oh.
Have you encountered this kind of situation?
I encounter maybe not that particular situation, but similar situations all the time. And that's what I mean by another sort of a sixth sense kicking in. And when I'm online, all of my senses come together in a different way than if I'm face-to-face. So, and it's not just with clients. I mean, I get emails in my inbox, and I can tell from the subject line what the tone of the email is going to be. So there are subtle cues and use of language that you become accustomed to, and particularly if you have an online client that you've established any sort of rapport with or you have a contractual relationship with, then you're going to be able to pick up on the nuances of where their story is flowing and where it's not. And then I would handle it the same way I would handle it face-to-face. I would ask additional probing questions and, you know, here's what I'm thinking, and, well, here's what you said, and I'm wondering if, and it's very much a similar process.
Yes.
Yeah, I think one of the things you do, one of the things you do with clients in any setting is you notice the baselines, and then you notice any variation from the baseline. It's the same thing with text. You know, you notice how this person relates to you in a general way. Anything that deviates from that, you see as something to note. And as you said, Deanna, then you decide what your intervention is going to be or how you're going to approach that, you know, in a way to invite the person to take a look at that or to share, you know, what might be behind that, those kinds of things. So, but once you get to do this for a little while, you start establishing a pretty clear baseline. And like you said, you know, if you've been with a client for a while, you know when something deviates and when you need to perk up on that, which brings me to you know, one question about online therapy, and that is, some people talk about an anxiety or a question about safety, and I wondered what your ideas were about that. Do you have certain ways that you handle that, protocols that you handle safety issues with that?
In terms of crisis intervention?
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, somebody's suicidal or somebody's, you know, really upset, those kinds of things.
Well, clearly, if I'm contracted with another entity like Chappelle, then I have a team behind me that helps me with the intake and the screening, and there's a 24/7 number available for clients. But when we're working independently in private practice, it's a little different. And so what I recommend is that people have a really, really solid intake process. And then by that, I mean that they're asking the same questions they would ask face-to-face, in addition to some other questions about technology, so that you have a sense of how familiar your client is with technology in general. You know, have they ever made a purchase online? Are they involved in social networking? Have they ever been in a chat room? You know, those sort of things just give you a real their level of comfort. And then, you know, I ask identifying questions like, you know, I mean, I can see people from all over the globe, so I ask for a passport number. I ask for an address. I ask for a location. I ask for a number to call in case of an emergency. And when I receive that record, I'm looking up. Not, you know, 911 doesn't work when you're in Europe. So 911's not going to do me any good if there's a crisis. So I literally look up backup information for my clients in whatever area they're in. Even in the United States, I would probably call the local police or sheriff's department before I would pick up my phone and call 911. And then we're using some of the same protocols we've used for years with hotlines. Hotlines have been in existence for, 40, 50 years, when people call in a number and they're in crisis, and sometimes those crises have to be intervened. Sometimes it's a local hotline. Sometimes it's a national hotline. So, you know, really what it means is that you have to do your due diligence before you take on the client, before you create the contract. And if there's any questions or concerns, you know, if I see that I have a client who has been in treatment before, then I'm going to talk about that and explore that. If I have a client that has a current psychiatrist or is on medication and has a diagnosis that I might want to give some thought to, then I ask for a release of information. So if there's ever a situation that I would consider a crisis, I can also speak to that other helping professional. So those are some of the ways that I safeguard that process within my own private practice.
Yeah, I think that's very important. It depends. I have seen some at-risk clients, and it's different with every client in terms of how much backup you need, and I get some of their local support systems, and like you say, get release of information to talk, prior to taking on that client, or if I have a certain concern, I tell them, if I'm going to feel that they're at risk, I'm going to contact that person. And we make that kind of contract because, like you say, so far away, and you don't know the local safety things as well as the people in the community. So I think you can get around that. Obviously, it's not the best idea to take on at-risk clients over the internet, but I think with the proper precautions, it can be done and done well.
And sometimes you don't know they're at risk until you're in the middle of the relationship with them.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. And then you have to talk about renegotiating the contract.
Right. Right.
Right, which is why it's important to get that information up front, whether there appears to be a crisis or not, whether they appear to
right.
be kind
sure.
of or not. Just go ahead and get the information.
Exactly.
I'm curious about your possible experience with doing online groups.
I've never done online groups. I know people, I have some colleagues that the people that I know that are doing groups successfully are doing groups in a virtual world. They're using Second Life, and both of the individuals I'm thinking of are doing aftercare for addictions after they've been in.
They're using Second what?
Second Life. It's a virtual world.
Oh, yes.
With
okay.
avatars, and, you know, you go in and you create yourself, and then you can show up at your therapist's office and sit in a room. And I know two organizations that are doing that very successfully right now. So, and then I know of an organization called E-Get Going who does video conferencing with substance abuse in the United States, and they're also very successful. But I myself have never done any group activities online. I have managed a, I guess you would call, peer clinical supervision group with people in a asynchronous sort of bulletin board forum fashion. But in terms of a therapy group, I've not done that.
Okay.
Well, let's talk about virtual world for a minute, because I think that's quite new and cutting edge. And I don't have really any experience with that. So tell us a little bit about virtual world. And I was very interested when you said that, you know, the experience with Asperger's clients. But tell me more about virtual world.
Well, virtual worlds are, some virtual world settings are like games. World of Warcraft is one of the most popular. And there's actually, you know, what I call a point to the process. You're entering the virtual world to play a game. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of virtual world games like Pirates of the Caribbean, and, you know, Johnny Depp is in character within the game, you know, the whole bit. And then there are virtual worlds like Second Life, which is one of the most popular, but certainly not the only one, where there's no game involved. It literally is a world. So I go into Second Life, and I create an avatar, and that avatar represents me in some way. For me, I have an avatar in Second Life, and my avatar is who I am in real life. I'm a therapist in world. I'm a therapist in real life. So it doesn't change. I'm not putting on a different persona, so to speak. Some people go into Second Life to put on a different persona. Some people go into Second Life to go to very dark places, just like people go to very dark places in real life. And some businesses set up a presence in Second Life akin to a 3D, three-dimensional website. So the Online Therapy Institute has an office in Second Life. People can, avatars can visit our office. They can read about what we do. And it's basically, at this point, an extension of the information we offer on our website. It's just another venue for us getting information out. But there are therapists who do therapy in Second Life. And Second Life is not an encrypted environment. So if you do therapy in Second Life, you have to bring on another platform like Skype, which is encrypted, to use the chat program or the voiceover program. But essentially, avatar therapy is a wonderful tool to use with people. I've used it on occasion to take a face-to-face client who I know is involved, and I will say, I want you to meet me in Second Life so you can present to me the presentation you give to everyone else in your virtual world. And it can be an absolutely powerful therapeutic experience. So
that's
one tool. That's one way you can use it. You can also use avatar therapy. We now have the technology to use artificial intelligence so that we can script entire scenes. So if you have somebody who wants to redo or for instance, wants to say goodbye to a loved one that died and they never felt like they had closure, you can go into a virtual world and you can create the avatar of the person that they lost, and you can literally create a goodbye scene. So it's like writing your own script. So I think that that is going to be a very, very powerful process in the future.
It sounds like Gestalt.
What's the technology?
It sounds like Gestalt therapy with actual, you know, avatar characters. You can make it even more real.
Yes.
Yeah, David.
And you can finish your own story.
Right.
You know, you create a vision board.
Or practice something new for the future too.
Right. Exactly.
Deanna, when you were describing that use, you mentioned artificial intelligence, and I'm really curious about the kinds of technological advances that are involved in, let's say, the situation you described where a scene is created in which one might say goodbye to a departed parent.
Mm-hmm. Well, if artificial intelligence exists so that avatar can be created, and the script can actually be generated so that when what I call the real-life avatar speaks to the deceased person, that script has already been generated, and it's like a real-time conversation.
You mean script in the sense of like a film script that's been written in advance and is being followed? Or
it can be written in advance and it can be followed, or it can be anticipated. I mean, we've had that technology for a long time. I mean, that goes back to Uncle Ezra, you know, in the 60s when you could talk to the computer and get some sort of generated response. And that technology has just, I mean, it's just, we're light years ahead of that now. And of course, I'm not a technology person at all. When somebody demonstrates that to me, my eyes are as wide as anybody else's because it's just so incredible. But the implications it has for the field are just, I mean, I think it's unknowing at this point.
I certainly say it would be the case. Is there any literature out, let's say popular literature, for somebody who is either interested in exploring the possibility of doing online counseling, you know, either from a client or from a counselor point of view, and or literature which also discusses the current state of the technology and the possibilities for the future?
We do a pretty good job at Online Therapy Institute of blogging anything that is new and fascinating and upcoming. So if people go to our blog, which is onlinetherapyinstituteblog.com, a little word cloud comes up on the side, and if you just click avatar or avatar therapy or online therapy or, you know, any topic that you want to see what we've written about, if any new latest and greatest articles have come out, we're usually blogging about it. So that's one way to get the information. Kate, Anthony, and I, who's the co-founder of Online Therapy Institute with me, we just finished a book entitled Therapy Online, a Practical Guide, which is a really good source for therapists who want to get started. We talk mostly about chat and email, but as the book progresses, the later chapters talk about other technology that's coming into place. So that's another.
Is that book available now?
Published?
It's available through Amazon.com.
I have a copy in my hand as we speak, which I got from Amazon.
Great. So that, you know, that's a, well, we tried to write it in very practical, in a very practical language, so so that it, because I think that at some point therapists need to embrace the technology, whether they ever want to call themselves an online therapist or not. They're going to have clients who are going to want to email them about changing an appointment, or, you know, text them that they can't make their appointment today. So on some level, on a very basic level, I think the field in general needs to be aware of what technology can offer and what some of the pitfalls are.
Indeed, indeed. Do you run into issues that have to do with licensing? Licensing, as I understand it, is, you know, often licensing.
In the United States, it's, I don't know how else to say it except to say it's a mess.
That's a good way to say it.
We don't have portability across state lines, particularly as a master's level therapist, I don't. I know psychologists can achieve that. I don't know what hoops they have to jump through, but they have a better chance of being able to practice across state lines than master's level therapists, which is the audience I most represent. So as a word of caution, I generally advise people that if they're going to practice within the states, they should consider practicing within state lines. And if they're going to practice within other states, they need to make sure that their malpractice insurance will cover it, and they need to follow the jurisdiction of both their state and the client's state. So if I'm in New Jersey and I have a client in Idaho, New Jersey may not have anything on the books about me practicing online. They don't care. They don't question it. But Idaho may. And even though Idaho may not come after me, so to speak, I need to respect the laws of Idaho. So it's probably not in my best interest to see that client in Idaho. Now, that's
virtually. You mean online?
Right, online. So that's my, that's sort of the, I guess the political line I walk. Philosophically, I think we should be able to see whoever we want to see when we want to see them. So if I want to see a therapist across the country or across the world, I should be able to do that. But we also have to take into consideration the legal and ethical implications of what we do.
Well, that's a good segue. That's a good segue into the ethical considerations. You want to elaborate on other ethical considerations of online therapy?
Well, the jurisdiction issue is a huge one. Knowing how to navigate those waters. And certainly one of the new ethical issues that is popping up everywhere is being able to maintain an ethical online presence so that you're not being friended by your clients, so that you're not being followed on Twitter by one of your clients. I get questions like that all the time. And so I have basically put social media into my informed consent process, so that my clients understand that if they want to friend me on Facebook, I'm not going to accept it. And that's because it could be considered a dual relationship, and there's a possibility that confidentiality could be broken because my friends will see their friends and somebody will connect those dots and know that, oh, well, maybe she's seeing this person, maybe she's a client. So that's sort of a new thing that's cropped up recently. Other ethical issues? Confidentiality is one of the biggest. You know, working within an encrypted, secure and encrypted environment. And I think a lot of therapists understand that now, but they don't take it all the way through. So, for instance, they use an encrypted platform like Hushmail or Skype, but they have a form on their website that says, fill this out and tell me all of your problems, all your dark secrets, and anything you want me to know, and click send. And if they don't have that form hosted on a secure and encrypted page, and it's not being encrypted as it's sent, then we've sort of defeated the entire purpose.
Right.
You know, they also do things like they will email between sessions, which, you know, to email housekeeping issues is fine, but if your tagline at the end says, Joe Smith, number one psychotherapist, Portland, Maine, then anybody that intercepts that email can connect the dots. And, of course, the words I always get from people are, well, what's the chance of that happening? Well, you know, what's the chance that somebody's going to break into my office and break into my file cabinet?
Right.
Probably not very high. But I still take
But you should lock your door, yes.
Right. So, you know, I think some of those basic, what I'm seeing now all over the Internet is psychologists and therapists who are deciding, I think, out of an effort to do something good, they're deciding to provide a place for consumers to come and talk. So they have a website, and then they have a support forum. And the support forum may be a grief support forum, cancer support, whatever that forum is. And the therapist may or may not choose to facilitate or even be a part of that forum. They just offer the platform. But they offer it without encryption and without security. So people come into these forums and tell their lifelong stories, tell really dark, intimate information, or just information that maybe they don't want the world to know. And I believe that the onus is on us to protect that information. So I think support forums are great, but I think they should be password protected and encrypted.
I agree.
So I assume it's not difficult to do that, right? It's not difficult to encrypt these various forms of communication?
No. In fact, in most cases, it's free. Hushmail is free, Skype is free. If you want an encrypted forum, I think you can get an encrypted forum for something like $300 a year. So it's not, it's not cost prohibitive.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about who you think would be the best suited for online therapy as a client. If somebody's out there thinking, I'm looking for some therapy, I don't know whether I should go face-to-face or online, what are some of the considerations in terms of whether you're suited for that?
I think some of the considerations are, again, I don't want to prejudge.
Right.
People who don't have experience with technology may find that they enjoy the process of being online. But in general, have they been online before? Have they, do they have the basic skills for technology? Do they have basic writing skills if text-based therapy is what you're going to do? But I wouldn't necessarily rule out any particular, I wouldn't sit here and say, oh yeah, no, they would never be good online, because I've dealt with so many different clusters of characteristics and personalities that, I think the common denominator is that they're making the effort, and this is something that they're seeking out.
Right. Yeah, and I think you can find that you get more comfortable with it, or you grow into it, or you see the advantages of it. I know, for me, when I first started out, doing e-therapy, the exchange of emails, I wondered, how connected I would feel with the client, and I became quite pleased in terms of, I felt very connected with the client, and when termination came, I felt the same kind of sadness about not seeing that person anymore. I had felt that involved with them. That's something obviously that you have to do. You have to let clients go when it's appropriate for them to go. But you do feel that little bit of loss and that little bit of regret, and I felt the same kind of thing with email-based therapy, and I was kind of pleased and amazed with that. You really get connected.
Well, it is a real relationship. It's no less
exactly.
Real.
There's
it's not any less valid than the relationships we have with our clients in our office.
Right.
It could be just...
Were you done? I didn't mean to interrupt. Dan, have you ever had the experience of having an online relationship with someone that you'd never met, and then for whatever reason you do meet that person, you do have one or more therapeutic sessions with that person, and this is a kind of a novelist sort of question.
Mm-hmm.
And you have had that experience. Is it like a continuation to see that person, somebody that you know already, or is there something jarring about it?
It can
that,
be...
that you had formed... I mean, jarring in the sense that you formed a sense of who this person is, and the in-person experience is in some curious way very, very different.
Yes. In fact, Kate and I wrote a little bit about that in the book, that in some situations, if you have started out with a text-based relationship, transferring that relationship to voice or face-to-face can disrupt the therapeutic alliance because of the preconceptions that we build in our heads about who our client is or who our therapist is, or the voice that
we
have the person in our head. And so, and I had a client years ago that actually her presenting issue was she was struggling with her body image. And one of the reasons she said she never went to a therapist was because she felt judged because of her size. And after about 6 months of us working in chat together, she was in the same state. She wanted to meet me and she was willing to travel to have a face-to-face session. And I used my clinical judgment at the time, and I did not think it would be a wise idea because we had been strictly text-based synchronous chat for 6 months. And so we talked, what we did with that was we talked about what was the motivation behind it. And we actually did good work online, and we kept the relationship online, and then I saw her online for another 6 months. So I do think it's a case-by-case basis. But I think, yes, that if you move from one modality to another or one method of delivery to another, you can, both parties can have an experience that can be disrupting to the alliance.
I actually had a couple of experiences like that. And it was interesting, having not seen the person face-to-face or, you know, any picture of them. I just had a picture in my mind. They came near where I have my physical practice, and so I had a session with them. It wasn't disruptive, but it was a little unsettling in terms of you have a rapport that you build in a certain way, and it takes a little time to reestablish that rapport with the actual person that's there in front of you. And when we went back to phone and email sessions, my picture of that person, although my picture was not radically different than how she looked in real life and in the presence, in my presence, when I would deal with her after that, the picture that I had as I dealt with her, as I wrote to her, talked to her on the phone, was the old picture, not the real her, which I thought was very interesting to me. I don't think it was disruptive to the relationship. It went on and it ended very, very positively in the end. But it was a surprising and interesting phenomenon for me.
And I think that's really what therapists just need to be aware of, that when you shift from one method to another, there may be some disruption, and just being aware of that can do wonders.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think the most important thing is to be aware, to talk about it, to do whatever working through needs to get worked through. So let's talk about
when you
go ahead, David.
Deanna, when you think about the medium, the development, well, the development of online work, and when you think about your own interest, what, if anything, in the future would you like to in terms of using various media for counseling, for whatever reason, haven't gotten to yet? What lies ahead, in other words?
Well, first, I would like to be implanted with a 15-year-old brain that's been using for five. Because one of the most difficult things is just keeping up with the technology. Having not been raised with technology, you know, there's a bit of a learning curve every time I pick a new method of delivery up to sort of explore it and see how it works. You know, some people Second Life and build their avatar in an hour, and, you know, it took me, I don't know, I went to Second Life probably 8 or 10 times. I was still learning how to walk, much less figure out how to make myself look different. And I use that as an example, but, you know, your comfort level with the technology clearly drives what you are willing to do as both a therapist and a client. And so for me, my next, obviously I'm interested in avatar therapy, but I want to combine the ability to have a visual like an avatar with sort of some psychoeducational tools that you could use through a conferencing platform like WebEx or Huddle, where you can have a whiteboard and I can hook them into my computer and show a PowerPoint presentation and really do some learning tools where I'm using voice, I'm using chat, I'm using typical learning tools, and I'm using the visual of a virtual world. You know, we can create collages and vision boards or any number of things. So just combining some of the technologies I think would be interesting, but you have to be able to present that to your client in a way that's not overwhelming.
Yes,
It might start very simply and build from there.
So before we end, I want to get to the issue of you know, who do you think is best suited as a therapist for online therapy? What kinds of trainings do you think is necessary? Obviously, that's something that you offer and do and have some experience in terms of, you know, who you've seen has been able to do this well and take to this, and who hasn't or who has a struggle with that. So what are some of the, you know, some of the things that if there's some therapists out there who are listening and wondering, you know, is this for me? What kinds of things should they be asking themselves about their, you know, their particular strengths or weaknesses that they bring to this?
You know, and this is for, I'm speaking to therapists, not clients, because clients may log in once a week for a session. But if therapists work online and incorporate technology, they'll be using the technology a lot. So the first sort of measure is, do you like being online? Do you like sitting in front of a computer? If you don't, then chances are you're not going to like it. It doesn't matter what you'll be doing with it. You could be playing solitaire or seeing a client. If you don't like the computer, it's probably not going to be a good fit. And then from there, it's, you know, if you like to write and you have a good grasp of language, then you might enjoy text-based therapy. If that's not really your style and you prefer having the visual and, you know, audio cues, then you might choose either phone or video conferencing. So I think you have to go with the basic characteristics of what you do right now. And even before 1999, I was one of those that was on the Internet way early, just exploring and doing searches and finding things and just fascinated with it. I'm not saying you have to necessarily have a high level of skill in terms of technology, because that's not true at all. But you do have to have a love for finding things out and learning how to do things in new ways. I think that's paramount. And beyond that, it's, you know, there are a lot of therapists who go to school who think they're going to get out of school and have a nice private practice with the proverbial box of tissue and you know, 30 or 40 clients a week, and those are the people that I'm seeing in my trainings. They're coming thinking that, well, I never was able to achieve that face-to-face for whatever reason, so now I'm going to be able to do it online. And that's not necessarily the right motivation. What I encourage therapists to do if they're interested in online therapy is to learn it, learn the best way to meld it into their current practice and use it with the clients they already have and begin offering that as additional services to clients who will come into their practice, because that's a good way to get started and get comfortable with it. But many therapists think that if they build a website, then they will come. And that it takes just as much energy to build a practice online as it does face-to-face. You know, you can't build a website in the middle of a desert. Nobody knows how to get there.
Right. And that's it. It's a whole different kind of marketing. It's a whole different, you know, different way for people to get to you. That leads into another question is, if there are people who are wanting to explore online therapy as clients, how do they find therapists? And how do they find a therapist that they think is a match for them? I mean, one of the things that I think is probably one of the most ubiquitous ones is Psychology Today as a website where you can find therapists. But there's also, you know, you can certainly Google and find therapists, and people find me all kinds of ways. But do you have some other tips for people in terms of trying to find a therapist?
Well, if you're trying to find a therapist, at the very least, you need to be able to verify the therapist. Credentials. You need to be able to know that they're using secure and encrypted processes to engage in the therapeutic relationship. Those are two very basic items. And to that end, Online Therapy Institute is developing a verify system whereby therapists who have a practice online and want to have their site verified by us, we will offer that service, and it will show that, you know, we're not guaranteeing that therapist, you know, is a good therapist or not, so to speak. What we're guaranteeing is that they follow basic ethical procedures and they offer encryption, they have protocols in place for crisis intervention, and that they are certified or licensed to be able to practice within their jurisdiction.
Right. So to that end, why don't you tell people how to get in touch with you so that if they're listening to this program and want to connect with you for supervision or therapy or whatever, they can find you.
OnlineTherapyInstitute.com is our website, and my this easiest email is info@OnlineTherapyInstitute.com. So you can just go to the contact page from the website and contact from there.
Great. Anything before we end? Deanna, we just have about a minute and a half left. If there's anything you want to say before we end,
it's been great.
I just want to say to you that I really appreciate you doing this interview with us. It was just very informative, and obviously you know so much about this and have thought so much through it. So really appreciate you being on here.
And I appreciate you bringing the topic to the forefront. I mean, that's so wonderful that you're doing that, because so many people still don't even know it's an option.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, great. Anything
Thank
you want to say?
Thank you,
Deanna.
I've been...
Okay, David. All right.
Thank you.
Yes, so thank you, Deanna. Hopefully we'll connect in other ways. Down the road.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, great. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, David. We'll say goodbye, and I'll tell people how to get in touch with me if they want to connect with me for online services. DrJimWeaver.com is where you can connect with me, or you can call me at 207-773-7993, extension 22. Plug you want to put in there, David?
Yeah, for myself, everydayloveblog.com is a very good place to start. Everydayloveblog.com.
Okay, great. All right, we'll see you next week, and goodbye now from the Darn Guys. Bye-bye.
Well, in the evening, we get together, long day.